Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and WETS-HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Say, have you ever wondered what happened after Constitution Day? I mean, we celebrate it. We celebrate it every year on September the 17th. It's a huge holiday out at Montpelier. And indeed, I'll just give you a heads up. They're going to be celebrating it this year, I think, on the Saturday following the 17th. I think it's going to be on the 21st this year. We'll nail that down later, but I'm pretty sure it is. It's a big day. Love to go. I've done an entire show devoted to Constitution Day at Montpelier. I'll probably do so again. But that marks the end of the Constitutional Convention in 1787. But as I'm sure you know, that wasn't the end of the process. It was, in one sense, the beginning. Because from that point forward, the Constitution went out to the states. And the states were asked to approve it, a process we call ratification. And the ratification process took roughly twice as long as the Constitutional Convention had taken. Constitutional Convention was about 4 months, and ratification was about 9 months. What happened during that nine-month period? That's a subject I'm going to freely admit to you I don't know nearly as much about as I would like to know. And so I was thrilled recently when my old buddy, Julie Silverbrook, who runs Consource, and regular listeners have heard me interview Julie on several occasions, when Julie said to me, hey, I've got this guy who knows everything there is to know about ratification. His name is John Kaminsky. He's the director for the study of the American Constitution at the University of Wisconsin, which is a wonderful center that does lots of important work. But its primary project, Julie told me, was the documentary history of the ratification of the Constitution, a process that will not take 4 months like the drafting. It will not take 9 months like the ratification, a process which, according to John Kaminsky, will take roughly 75 years, 75 years from start to finish to collect all the various letters and other documents that tell us what went on during that extraordinarily important nine-month period. Now, the only problem I had talking to John was that I think we sat down and talked for close to 2 hours. And as a practical matter, I could not use all of that audio in this episode. In fact, I'm going to have to do 2 episodes. This is going to be part one of our series on ratification. But even then, I had to cut a lot out. And I'm sorry about that, John, but it was just too much. So let me just summarize. The first part of our conversation, we talked about why the states had ratifying conventions rather than having the legislatures of the states consider them. And it basically boiled down to two things. The legislatures had a vested interest in the status quo, so there was institutional resistance to anything, any change, including this new Constitution. And secondly, by adopting ratification conventions with very broad suffrage, with rules that allowed lots of people to vote, not just the usual suspects, not just wealthy white guys who own property, we extended the franchise much more broadly. Now, not broadly enough, not to women, not to minorities, certainly not to slaves, but it was a broader referendum than it otherwise would have been. And then, of course, the Constitution was sent to Congress up in New York, which was still meeting under the Articles of Confederation, and it also went out to the states. That's where we're going to pick up our conversation with John Kaminsky.
The Constitution arrives in each state in various ways, but when it arrives, the public debate starts. And this is done in various media. Primarily in the print media. In the newspapers, there are about 95 newspapers being published at any one time during this ratification period. About 70 newspapers in the North and 20 in the South. Some states like New York and Massachusetts might have a dozen newspapers. Other states have maybe four. South Carolina has four, all in Charleston. Mm-hmm. Whereas the dozen newspapers in Connecticut are spread out throughout the entire state. And so there's a far more literate population in the North than the South. But newspapers are a vehicle which spreads the news in the public debate over the Constitution. You get pamphlets and broadsides that are being published. A broadside is technically one sheet, but sometimes it's a multi-page. And so the Constitution is printed in a 6-page broadside by the Constitutional Convention, and then in a 4-page broadside by Congress, along with their resolutions in those broadsides. That gets distributed. And so you have a significant period of time, a month to maybe 4 months, before the state legislatures meet, in which the public debate is going on. And that could be also in taverns, in churches, public and private correspondence. So everyone is talking about this. It is a national issue.
Is this the period in which Hamilton and Jay and Madison start writing the so-called Federalist Papers?
Exactly. And it's interesting to note that they do this primarily. It's Hamilton who mm-hmm. gets the idea in response to the anti-Federalists, the opposers of the Constitution. They start a series first by Cato, only about 10 days after the Congress sends the document to the states. But you get others, for instance. Cato starts, and then it's responded to by Caesar. Cato has 6 essays. Caesar has 2. It's thought that George Clinton, the governor of New York, wrote Cato, and it's thought that Hamilton wrote Caesar. Well, Caesar was quite heavy-handed. In its second number, he says, if you don't accept this Constitution, we'll cram it down your throats. We'll get the American Fabius. The American Fabius is George Washington.
Right.
And he'll make sure it's adopted.
Are you serious? He threatened military action.
Of course. And so that heavy-handed approach is not smiled upon. And then when Brutus comes out, who's a very effective, and there's some disagreement as to who Brutus was. I think the evidence shows that it was a man by the name of Melancthon Smith, a lieutenant of George Clinton's in New York. And he, in a very dispassionate way, starts the discussion. I think there are 16 numbers of Brutus. It's a phenomenal series. And Hamilton sees, as does Madison, we've got to change our approach and address this in a more dispassionate way, and not in a partisan, provocative way, as Caesar had done. Now, Caesar wasn't the only one. There were many other Federalist Papers. But the first number of the Federalist Papers...
Well, full knowledge, John, first of all, I have to comment, of course, they're all using these Roman pseudonyms, which I find fascinating, because, of course,
yes,
all these guys are steeped in Roman history, Greek history, and all of that. The second part of this is that, you know, Hamilton had the reputation of being very arrogant. And
yes,
it sounds like that was his first response when he saw Cato and when he saw George Clinton coming out against the Constitution. He's just going to hit him back really hard. And I almost have the sense that probably Madison kind of sidles up to him one evening and says, you know, Al, this is not the way to do it. Is there any evidence that it was Madison who moderated Hamilton?
There's no evidence of that? Well, not only is there no evidence of that, there is evidence to show that's not the case.
Oh, really? Well, then tell me what was.
You commented, Stuart, about Hamilton being so provocative and having great initiative, and he felt that way about the military and also politics. And so in the when the Constitutional Convention is meeting in secret, he comes out on in July 21st of 1787, right in the middle of the Constitutional Convention, and attacks George Clinton as being an opposer, Governor George Clinton.
He's not even there.
That's right. But he's an opposer. He has supposedly said whatever comes out of the convention, he's going to oppose. Now, many people at the time and historians later said that Hamilton jumped the gun here, and he forced Clinton into a corner to be an anti-Federalist. Well, Hamilton's point of view is he's long gone. He's going to be an anti-Federalist. And so what he usually would do is wait to the appropriate time and then come out publicly when the tipping was there, and he would tip it over to his side. Hamilton was going to take away that initiative from Clinton, expose him for what he was in advance, and you get rid of that issue. He's in the enemy camp. And so that's the kind of initiative that Hamilton had. And so when he sees Brutus coming along and we've got to respond, whether the only issue would be, and very few of us take this point of view, was Jay in cahoots with him in the...
John Jay.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
John Jay, in setting it up, or was Jay a collaborative after the initial idea. We're not sure about that. But these two men get involved. and they write the first five numbers. Hamilton writes the first number.
Now we're talking about the Federalist papers.
Yes, and again, 27th of October, right. 1787. So you see, it's 6 weeks after the convention has come out with the Constitution. They didn't do it right away. They're responding to men like Cato and Brutus. And I should mention to you, you mentioned the frequent use of these pseudonymous names. And that's done for two reasons. The first is they want to make this an issue-oriented debate and not a debate over personality. Mm-hmm. Now, many of these writers were well-known for the pseudonym that they used. For instance, Tom Paine was well-known to be Common Sense, mm-hmm. he was signed. And, but still, there's a greater sense of anonymity by not putting your name to it. The other thing is, this is a time when you like anonymity because there are occasions where political disagreement would turn violent, and you can have the use of caning people. You cane someone who's below your dignity. You don't want to challenge them to a duel. That's the other side. So your life could depend upon that anonymity that your pseudonym gave you, that you didn't want to divulge who you were.
And it's a rough time.
Yes. Sometimes in several states, Massachusetts and Georgia, printers, Federalist printers, with the Federalist point of view, they would refuse to publish anything, any essay that didn't have the name of the person attached, not to be printed, but to be lodged with the printer, to be divulged to anybody who wanted to know who the author was. And so anti-Federalists disagreed with this policy because they felt that their access to the press was limited, and that was a restriction on them. But Hamilton, at least, comes up with the idea for the Federalist Papers. He writes the first number, which is wonderful, introducing it. He says, this is a time that will decide whether men from reflection and choice can adopt a constitution for themselves rather than relying upon accident or force.
You know, that is one of my favorite quotes because mm-hmm. that, to me, defines the American experiment.
Absolutely.
That one statement right there. Can we do this? Can we get together and decide among ourselves with reasoned debate what sort of government we want to have rather than having it imposed upon us by some conqueror, by some strongman?
Well, the answer to that question is we're still working on it.
Yes, it's still an open question.
That's
every
right.
day it's an open
That's
question. Right.
Right. Yes, and so we've been practicing it for over 200 years.
So far, so good.
Some would argue maybe not so good right now as we see how Congress works.
Right. Okay.
And so
this is fascinating. So these guys have all these good reasons for being anonymous. They engage in these debates. The most famous of them is the Federalist Papers. But that didn't occur in isolation. It occurred in response to anti-Federalist screeds.
That's right.
And as a compromise between the initial and very bombastic or at least arrogant or overly aggressive response that Hamilton initially favored. Okay, so the debates are ongoing. What happens next?
It's a wonderful thing to see this public debate in the newspapers. As I mentioned, there are about 90 newspapers. The newspapers are generally four pages long. They usually devote two of those four pages to the public debate. There was no news service at the time, like a UPI or AP service, but newspaper printers exchanged their newspapers. And so a typical newspaper printer might get four newspapers free of any postage. That is before January 1st of 1788. They changed the rule at that point. Yeah. But before that, free exchange of newspapers, and they would cut and paste. So a newspaper printer in Philadelphia might put news from other states on one page. So they would put a dateline of Hartford, 25 October, and that would be the latest news from Hartford, from a Hartford newspaper of that date, or Savannah. And this is the way they exchange information. And so in our collection at the Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution, we have collected all of these. And so we can see, for instance, here we're at George Mason University. His objections to the Constitution are published in probably 30 newspapers throughout the country.
Huh.
Sometimes there's a variety of methods of publishing. With Mason's objections, there is. So, for instance, after circulating for about 2 months in private manuscript form, some that Mason let out on his own, and then derivative offshoots, people copying down those objections. They get published in 3 newspapers consecutively. That is, on the 21st of November, they're published in the Massachusetts Sentinel in Boston. On the 22nd of November, they're published in Alexandria, Virginia. On the 23rd, the very next day, they're published in the Winchester, Virginia Gazette in the Great Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. Each one is a little different than each other. And in fact, the Massachusetts version leaves out an all-important objection, which is a Southern objection to the Constitution. It would not be a Northern objection.
Oh, so it was by design.
Yes, and so they left out intentionally. And they're called for it. The Federalists see that that objection was obliterated in the Northern publication. So they exchanged their information in this way. So the newspapers of the 96 are anti-Federalist, and they won't publish much Federalist material unless it be maybe a straw man to have a response. And then there are another 6 that are neutral. That means there are about 78 that are extremely Federalist, and they publish almost all Federalist material. And they'll publish the Federalist papers, interestingly enough, that people love to read this. It's entertainment for them. We could never have that done today.
No, we couldn't. But essentially, there isn't a modern parallel, and people bemoan the fact of the division of the media now. We have MSNBC on the left, we have Fox News on the right, and they contrast that with the 3 television networks that were all supposedly neutral just a couple of decades ago. Partisanship in the media is actually the norm, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I'm not talking about partisanship now. What I'm talking about is a very intellectual level of political discourse.
But nonetheless, each side, they pick sides. Even yes, though the high-level discourse, but they were on different sides.
Yes, but even the Federalist newspapers will publish some anti-Federalist material. But they publish this high-level, also very low-level, some of these items. But there's also what we call squibs. These are little tiny fillers, information from other states. And it sort of has a profound impact when you see over and over again this bandwagon approach. Things are going along well, and you're just bombarded with wonderful news about the convention. And so the public goes from being completely in favor of this Constitution to learning more and more, and there's a, by November, they're solidly in favor of this Constitution. But then the anti-Federalists start having some impact. And by the end of December, when the Massachusetts Convention is elected, there's probably a majority of the American people who oppose this Constitution.
Really?
Without amendments. They want amendments to this. And so you can see the impact that the public media, public debate, and the media has. And it's different in each of the 13 states, because the debate over the ratification of the Constitution really is 14 separate debates. You could say maybe even more. That is, each state had its own within the matrix of their politics. Then there's a national debate that's going on, and there's information that's being shared throughout the country. And then there are also regional debates. And so certainly in the South, they will view the constitutional provisions over slavery in a different way than it's viewed in the North. And so you have that kind of regionalism debate that's there. And so it is pervasive throughout the entire country. It spills into the taverns and the meeting houses, the churches, sermons are given on this. But the public is fully engaged. And
you alluded to something a moment ago that I wanted to ask you about. You said that it was by December of 1787, there was perhaps a majority of people who were opposed to ratification of the unamended Constitution. The big issue was the lack of a Bill of Rights, wasn't it?
There are 2 broad issues where anti-Federalists disagree. They disagree on everything in the Constitution,
right?
First of all. But there are 2 broad issues. One is the lack of a Bill of Rights, and that's in the context that we talked about earlier of 180 years of written documents protecting rights. Over 200 of these documents. The Massachusetts Bill of Liberty written in 1641, mm-hmm. Has all the rights that are in the U.S. Bill of Rights and more. Rights for women, rights for children, rights for aliens, rights for servants, that would include what we consider servants, indentured servants and slaves, rights for animals. You could not work your horse or you drive your cattle too much in a day. You'd be fined. So this body of liberty in Massachusetts, that's 50 years before the English Bill of Rights, 150 years before the U.S. Bill of Rights. So the Americans had this tradition, and now they create a government of tremendous power, unlimited power, and yet there's no Bill of Rights.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Kaminsky, the director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution, all about the ratification process. What happened after the Constitution was written in the summer of 1787? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll speak some more with John Kaminsky. Stick around. Okay, we're here on an absolutely gorgeous day at Montpelier, and I'm here with Kelly, our quiz lady, of course, and several contestants outside the visitor center. What are your names?
We have a whole
Janet
this week.
Janet.
Ronnie.
Deanna.
Deanna.
Ron.
And Ron. And where are you all from?
Michigan.
Where?
Yale. Greenwood.
Where is Greenwood?
Just outside of Yale.
You got to show us the hand.
Okay.
for those listening right now, we're holding up the hand.
Yeah, I got the hand.
Yeah, we're right here. Right where Lake Huron empties into St. Clair River.
So right at the base of the thumb and where the thumb and the hand connect.
Okay. I have been to Yale, Michigan.
No.
I have been to Yale.
To the Bologna Festival?
There's a Bologna Festival.
I have not been to the Bologna Festival at Yale. I have been to Yale when I was up staying at a little inn on Lake Huron, right nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there. I was right near Croswell County, wasn't it?
Yes.
I've been there as well. I saw an Elvis impersonator at your VFW hall when I was there. And I am actually from just south of there in Rochester.
Oh, really?
Now that we've given you this buildup, now the honor of the state of Michigan is at stake.
Oh, gosh.
And now
I'll tell you a secret. I used to live in Midland, Michigan.
Oh, you're kidding.
So what's the Michigan issue?
The Michiganers. Yes. Okay,
yeah,
here we go.
Put them down.
Okay,
oh,
here we go. Here's our quiz.
Are you guys ready for a good question? Yeah. There's a hat at stake, isn't there, today?
There is a hat.
Not a t-shirt this week.
No, it's a hat.
It's more pride.
Yeah, okay.
Right,
pride
at stake.
Okay, here we go. All right. The best source of information about how a nation's government is organized is A, dictionary, B, government report, C, constitution, or D, speech by a government leader.
So we want the best source of how a government is organized.
Exactly.
Okay. And what were our choices again?
The answer choices are A, a dictionary, B, a government report, C, a constitution, or D, speech by a government leader.
C. Constitution.
C.
Constitution.
Everyone's
nodding.
You jumped right to answer choice C. Young man, you didn't answer.
Constitution.
I think he's just going with the majority here. Now, why did you answer Constitution?
Because they did.
Why did the rest of you answer Constitution?
Because it fills all the bills. It answers all the questions.
Well,
there's no political views involved. Mm-hmm. The dictionary is only limited, mm-hmm. I think.
Although I think politicians sometimes have views about the Constitution.
They do.
They
could be politically motivated in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And
why did you answer Constitution?
Well, it's what our country started with, you know, the founding fathers and the basis of how it all started, and it worked for them then. And uh-huh. I feel that it's a good document that we need to stay with.
When we need to study.
Well, who's the father of the Constitution?
James Madison.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's a bonus question.
Just want to make sure.
Bonus question. Well, I mean, that's a fantastic answer, isn't it, Kelly? Because
it is.
I think that's correct.
It's correct. Congratulations.
Yay. Congratulations. You're going to get a hat. But let's just talk about what that is. I mean, this goes to the very definition of what a constitution is. Right. It's the document that organizes your government. Mm-hmm. And right. So it's much better than a dictionary. Yes. I would. Anyone listening, you definitely should.
Right, right.
It's lasted longer than any other.
Any other? I'll tell you what, yes. They know all kinds of stuff. It is the oldest operating. And they love America too. Yeah. Aren't they? Isn't it? The state of Michigan is proud of you today.
Oh, I hope so.
So here it is. Who gets the hat?
Papa.
Papa gets the hat. He's already wearing a bikeweed hat. Not bikeweed hat. Now you have one from your weekly constitutional.
Appreciate it. Thank
Congratulations.
You.
Thank you. And thank you for taking our constitutional
thank you.
Quiz.
And thanks for visiting thank James you. Madison's Montpelier.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Kaminsky, the director of the Center for the Study of the American Constitution. And we're talking all about the 9-month process that followed the Constitutional Convention, the process of ratification. As John was telling us just before the break, one of the main arguments that the people opposed to the Constitution had, the anti-federalists, was that the original 7 articles of the Constitution had no Bill of Rights. Mm.
And so that is one of the primary issues. And it's used by those people who are truly disturbed that there's no Bill of Rights, and by those who are more politically oriented, how do we defeat this?
Right.
And let's use this issue. How many fell in each of those camps? Who knows? But then the other major issue, umbrella issue, is the new federal-state relationship. And perhaps this Constitution is going to abolish states as working entities. Maybe they'll still be there to perfunctorily perform certain duties, like electing senators, which is provided in the Constitution. But no real authority. All the authority will devolve to the central government. So those are the two big issues.
Before we leave that one, now that was a real fear. In fact, there were some, if I recall correctly, at the convention who would have liked to see states abolished. In fact, George Washington was among them, wasn't he?
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No,
okay.
No. Certainly Hamilton would be part of that group, uh-huh. Although he would deny it. He did deny it later on.
Right.
And in fact, there's a debate in the New York Convention mm-hmm. that approaches a duel when John Lansing Jr., who served with Hamilton and Robert Yates in the Constitutional Convention, Lansing takes Hamilton to task when Hamilton says he favors states in the New York Convention. Lansing says, no, I was there in the Constitutional Convention where you said you wanted to get rid of the states. And Hamilton says, no, I never said that. And as I said, it almost ended in a duel. Their friends smoothed it out. Mm-hmm. Similarly, in Virginia, Edmund Randolph almost got in a duel, and his friends had to smooth that out. And so there are these important issues about federal-state relations.
Where did Washington stand on that, then?
I would say he's like most Americans. He believed that the states were very important mm-hmm. and that I think Jefferson said it best in 1799 when talking about how to interpret the Constitution. He said, I would like to see the Constitution implemented the way Federalists in the debate over the ratification, the way the Federalists said it would be implemented, not the way that anti-Federalists feared, and not the way it has been going, Jefferson says, which is far more power in the central government than they were advocating back in 1787 and 1788. And so there's the Americans, it's interesting to see, I think, that they were used to a federal system. They advocated a federal system. Historians like to say that the American Constitution created this new government. That's not true in many respects, at least in a operative sense. That is, the period of benign neglect that the British adopted created a federal system, whereas the imperial government was in charge of international relations and trade. But for all other matters internally, the colonial government was in charge.
Well, that is a fascinating point. We actually had grown up during that 170 or so, 180-year period between the time we founded our colonies, or the British founded the colonies in this part of the world, and we had our independence and our constitution. We had an overall umbrella government, it was distant, and it didn't bother us too much. And then we had local colonial or state governments. It really was analogous to the system we have now, isn't it?
Yes.
So now, what happened is the states' rights issue has been with us before there were even states.
Colonial rights system.
Colonial rights. Well, that's very interesting.
Yes. The British didn't object to this. In fact, they relished it because it didn't cost them any money. Mm-hmm. There were no forts established in America to enforce the colonial status. Americans were very happy to be part of the British Empire. And they sometimes objected to a little heavy-handedness here or there by a colonial governor. And when the Parliament passed the Navigation Acts that provided for control of navigation, control of commerce, what the Americans could do, what they could manufacture at home, how they had to deal with European countries, mainly dealing with England and not others. The Americans had to pay some taxes, but the Americans always found ingenious ways to avoid the Navigation Acts. They were great smugglers, right. Americans. And so the phrase that is often associated with the American Revolution, Americans wanted representation, no taxation without representation. That's not exactly accurate. Mm-hmm. Americans want no taxation with or without representation. They don't want taxation. And so under the Navigation Acts of the 17th century, the Americans found a way to smuggle. And they paid maybe one-tenth of the taxes they were supposed to pay. The customs collectors were part of the scheming. You paid off folks. There was a wonderful discussion that took place in the early 1790s at Jefferson's home. Washington had gone home to Mount Vernon, and so they were discussing various issues in Jefferson's home. Jefferson is in charge, Secretary of State. I don't know if you remember back when President Bush was shot. Al Haig said, "I'm in charge."
Right, I'm in charge here. Yes, right. Yes.
Well, that's true. Back in the 1790s, Secretary of State was in charge, and at this dinner that they were having at Jefferson's house, they started to discuss the British Constitution. And Hamilton says it's the best constitution Adams says it's the best constitution in the world if we could get rid of the corruption. Now, what he meant by corruption was favoritism and parceling out jobs and cronyism. He said if we get rid of that, it's terrific. Hamilton says it's the best constitution with the corruption, and it will not be without the corruption. And so this is integral to a government. Now, that's going to change under the new constitution that we adopt. One of the first things that the judges talk about is we must stop the smuggling. And we must indict smugglers. And we must indict those customs collectors that will allow the smuggling to continue. Because this is the blood that's going to enliven the whole government. And so they do adopt this policy that taxation through import duties is viable. But
in fact, that was Hamilton's innovation. I mean, he was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he, right?
Yes. There's a nice little story, though. A man by the name of Jeremy Olney in Rhode Island, he says he's the collector of customs in Providence, and he writes to Secretary of the Treasury, Hamilton, and says, I'm having difficulty. The merchants who always found ways to smuggle their goods in before the Constitution, in colonial times and under the Confederation, now object to my adamancy that there's no smuggling. What am I to do? And Hamilton wrote back and said, close one eye. Allow them to do a little smuggling, maybe 10%. Let them get away with it.
Really?
As if they think they're getting something, and maybe they'll be more amenable. So here the Secretary of State is endorsing a limited amount of smuggling.
Now he'd rather have 90% than nothing,
that's right.
I guess.
Okay. That's right. The judges don't take that point of view. And if you look at the charges to the grand jury, which are sort of speeches, pep talk, etc., John Jay, as Chief Justice, gives the first. He says in a very eloquent statement that this is this new system that we have, and we must collect these tariffs. and it's the lifeblood of the new union. It's a wonderful document. And we see this major transformation that now, if you're a smuggler, you're no longer a patriot. You're an outlaw.
Right.
And there's a major transformation.
That is major because, of course, if I recall correctly, that's how John Hancock, the big signature guy in our Declaration, made his fortune, wasn't it? Was as a smuggler under the British.
No, not really.
You're exploding all my myths here today, John. Okay, well, tell me what exactly did happen with Hancock.
He inherited his fortune from his uncle.
Well, that's what I meant to say. His fortune was based upon
Now, he continues the practice.
Okay.
And his ship, the Liberty, is seized by the British during this 10-year preliminary struggle.
Right.
So it wasn't... I don't want to give Hancock too much credit as being the great businessman that he wasn't.
Right.
He inherited this huge fortune, and he generously contributed that not only to the financing of the revolutionary movement, but the revolution itself. And he did many things that were very generous with his money to a fault. You might say, from a businessman point of view, squandering his money. He did other things as well that maybe were not so generous. He was not an astute businessman, but he was lucky that his uncle was.
Fascinating stuff, but I think, once again, we've digressed a little bit away from it, but we did identify the two major anti-federalist positions that were gaining traction as of December of 1787, and that was the Bill of Rights, or the lack thereof, and states' rights, broadly defined. Two big issues. So
yes.
What happens then after December of 1787? Does the tide begin to turn back?
Well, let me preface that by saying there's a major misconception about the ratification process, that it was a contest between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. And that's clearly marked. Well, it's not so clearly marked. If we look at the continuum here, or a spectrum, whatever way you want to picture this, going from the individual, we line them up back to back, and list them in order of those who support the Constitution and those who oppose the Constitution. So at the beginning, we have all these arch-federalists, and at the end, we have these arch-anti-federalists. Now, where does a man like Hamilton fall on that? Where would you put Hamilton, Seward?
I would have considered him very much on the federalist side, an arch-federalist.
Yes. Now, where he falls on that continuum is all the way on the other end as an anti-federalist.
Hamilton?
Yes.
This one you got to explain to me.
Yes. Everyone in the country opposes something in the Constitution. There is nobody who says this is 100% a good Constitution. So no matter who you are, no matter how much you favor the Constitution, there's something you oppose. And two of the strongest opposers of the Constitution happened to be Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. Now, they're not viewed that way by us when we're looking back, and to a great extent, they're not viewed that way by their contemporaries, but they're viewed that way by themselves. And so what they both say, Hamilton comes out expressing and says, if anybody should oppose this Constitution, it's me, because I don't like it. It's not what I want. And Madison is so discouraged at this Constitution. He says to Jefferson, I'll write you when the veil of secrecy is removed, and I'll tell you what happened. It takes him 6 weeks to write the letter. He writes a letter on the 24th of October. The Constitution is public. The rule of secrecy is dismissed on the 17th of September. So it's 6 weeks. And in a digression, a three-page digression, Madison tells Jefferson why I don't like this Constitution, why I failed. I didn't get a congressional power to veto every state law that's passed,
mm-hmm.
not just laws that are in contravention of the Constitution, but every single state law. And I didn't get a council of revision, which is what New York had that in its Constitution, that provided, in essence, for a third branch of the legislature, mm-hmm. made up of the judiciary, some element of the judiciary, and the president. So we would not have a presidential veto, but a council of revision veto. And every bill passed by the two houses would have to go to the council. Madison failed.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Kaminsky all about the ratification of the Constitution. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll find out what's happening this week at Montpelier. Stick around.
Madison spent much of her life at the pinnacle of American society, but she did not start out there. Dolly Payne was born May 20, 1768, in Guilford County, North Carolina. Her Quaker parents, John and Mary Coles Payne, were members of the New Garden Meeting of the Society of Friends. The Paynes moved to Virginia in 1769, settling in Hanover County. In 1783, Dolly's planter father freed his slaves, although it was not a condition of Quaker membership at the time, and moved his family again, this time to Philadelphia. John Payne began to work as a laundry starch merchant. This was the first of his many attempts to achieve financial stability, all of which failed. Indeed, Dolly would not experience financial security until she married her first husband, Philadelphia attorney John Todd, in 1790, when she was 21 years old. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
All right, Sean O'Brien from James Madison's Montpelier. What is happening this week at Montpelier?
This week at Montpelier, we're celebrating the sesquicentennial of the Civil
what?
War.
The what is a sesquicentennial?
It's sesquicentennial is 150th. It's a.
Okay.
It's one of those words that you really have to practice in front of the mirror before you try and use it in public.
Sesquicentennial. I can do it.
You can do it. You're great. Very good. Well,
thank you very much.
You've got a natural radio voice.
I'm a radio guy. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Go on.
For the sesquicentennial, we have a number of Civil War activities happening at Montpelier. Montpelier, as you know, is not only the home of James Madison, but was the home of a lot of history, American history.
Indeed, Dolly sold it.
Indeed, Dolly sold it. Yeah. There were six owners between the Madisons and the DuPonts who owned it starting in 1901. And during the Civil War, after the Battle of Gettysburg, soldiers came to Montpelier and encamped at Montpelier.
A friendly encampment.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the owner at the time allowed them to come.
They were Southern soldiers, and it was in the South.
Right.
So it was okay. it was a friendly encampment. And we do a number of reenactments throughout the course of the year related to the Civil War. And August 2nd to the 4th, which is a Friday through Sunday, we'll have our summer Civil War encampment reenactment. And people can come to Montpelier and actually, for free, go to the encampments and interact with some of the reenactors from the Civil War.
So there will be a bunch of Confederate reenactors hanging out. They got tents.
They got tents. They got huts, actually,
that
they made. Oftentimes, we have people who are doing photography from the period.
Oh, cool.
And a number of other things. So it's pretty neat. You know, they have the big blanket that they throw over their heads.
No way. That is so cool. Like daguerreotypes or later generations of daguerreotypes.
Exactly.
Like the Brady photographers. Okay, cool. And so
that's a fun weekend activity.
This is a very fun weekend. In fact, I've brought my kids when they were younger, both my boys, I would bring them these various Civil War reenactments. They loved, of course, when they would show the muskets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You got the muskets, right?
Sometimes we do the live fire demonstrations. Doug Smith, who I know is on your show quite regularly,
He's on probation on the show. He's the new quiz guy. We're not sure if we're going to keep him. He's not quite as good as Kelly, but but you're his boss. You talk to him about that, okay?
We'll work on it.
Okay, good.
He experienced live fire demonstrations when he lived on the Montpelier property, and needless to say, that's very exciting when after dark and after your children are asleep, cannons start firing.
My boys would probably like that, but I know what you mean. Okay.
Three-year-olds are not so fond of that.
All right. So once again, when is this coming up?
This is August 2nd to the 4th.
Right.
Also in August, you can participate in archaeological expeditions, and you can come and stay at Montpelier for a week and participate in our archaeological digs. And our archaeologists will teach you how to dig in the dirt and find things. And what's really fun is the people who participate in the archaeological expeditions often find the really coolest stuff. And so we've had visitors come for a week, participate in the archaeological digs, and find, for example, a Madison wine seal.
No way.
Which is neat. So they find some of the greatest stuff.
So this is not just for their fun. It's actual real digging.
This is real digging. This is real research that helps us interpret and understand the history of Montpelier.
I want to come, Sean. I want to come in August.
You're welcome to come.
Thank you so very much.
We have several weeks of this in August.
Tremendous. Well, Sean O'Brien of James Madison's Montpelier, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Kaminsky, the director for the Center for the Study of the American Constitution at the University of Wisconsin. We're talking all about the ratification process. And one of the things John told me that I really had never thought about was that even some of the people who were most ardently in favor of the new Constitution's ratification, people like James Madison and George Washington, were nonetheless disappointed in many of the provisions in the final document.
So he's very discouraged and says, you know, it's not as, I don't know whether it will work. So these two men were very, very saddened by what happened at the convention. But eventually they came around, didn't take very long for Hamilton, took longer for Madison, to realize what they had was certainly better than what was in existence at the time. Mm-hmm. And so they said, let's get this adopted. Very similarly, in the first Congress, when senators from Virginia, Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson, write back to Patrick Henry, and they say, we didn't get the amendments we wanted. We only got the rights amendments proposed, not the structural amendments to the Constitution. What a terrible thing. Within 2 weeks, Richard Henry Lee writes back again, we got half a loaf. Half a loaf, the Bill of Rights, is better than nothing. So we'll struggle to get more amendments to the Constitution. So that's the way it was with Hamilton and Madison.
Of course, these days we hear a lot about people who are unwilling to compromise.
Yes.
You can't have a representative democracy without compromise. And
yes.
We never have had one that worked. And in fact, it's those periods of history when we can't compromise is when we have governmental breakdown.
Yes.
So if I were in Congress, regardless of which party I was in, what I'm not taking positions on political issues now, but I don't have any great sympathy or respect for people who simply say my way or the highway. Then you want to be king is what you want to be.
Yes.
Okay. What turns the tide? As you know, things are looking bad as of December of 1788. What turns the tide?
Well, they're not looking bad yet. They don't know what has happened. Things happen instantaneously in our world, communication-wise. That's not the case back then. And so for the first five states that meet, the Federalist position is you adopt this in toto or you reject it. No amendments. They won't even be allowed to be discussed if the Federalists will stop it. And so we get Pennsylvania meets first, but Delaware sneaks in and they
first
call their convention.
State, right.
Yes, they only discuss the Constitution for 4 hours and then they adopt. Whereas Pennsylvania, two-thirds Federalist the convention, and they allow the debate to go on for 3 weeks. But they adopt, so you get first Delaware, then Pennsylvania, then New Jersey, then Georgia, and then Connecticut. Three of those unanimously, the state conventions. The other two by two-thirds majority. And now Massachusetts comes together. And you've got almost 400 delegates. That mirrors.
This was all during the fall of 1787, and Massachusetts meets when?
It starts in the convention in Pennsylvania starts in November, ratifies on the 12th of December. A week before that is when Delaware ratified, and then Connecticut ratifies the 9th of January.
Okay.
Now, Massachusetts elects its delegates in December.
Okay.
And so, whatever results, we don't know what's going to happen there in Massachusetts, that will give a good indication of the public opinion on the Constitution. And so, this is the first time that so many men have come together in Massachusetts. And the reason for that is that under their House of Representatives, the representatives were paid by the town. And so if the town in backcountry Massachusetts didn't have the resources, they wouldn't send delegates. And so the House of Representatives was never fully represented. they would have maybe 100, maybe 200 members there, not 400. But now the convention, the state ratifying convention, is going to be paid by the state. And so all the towns send their delegates, and there are about 400 of them. And we don't know at the time, when I'm putting myself back there,
right.
We don't know who these people are. And so it's uncertain what direction they will take. And consequently, John Hancock, who's a consummate politician, a fence sitter to a great extent, who wants to be on the right side and will follow the winds of politics rather than lead, he decides that he wants to be president of the convention, but he is unfortunately, and I say that with some hesitation, stricken with an attack of the gout. I don't know if you've ever had the gout or your listeners, but I have the gout, and it is as painful as you can imagine. Oh. You cannot imagine the pain. There's about nothing worse. I have in my study at home a recliner, and I have a ceiling fan. If I have an attack of the gout in my toe or in my ankle, I can't have the fan on. The pressure is too great. You can't have a sheet on. The weight is too bad. Now, we have medicines today that get rid of it almost instantaneously. They didn't then. They suffered for weeks or months at a time, and it is totally debilitating. And so Hancock had the almost, he could will himself having the gout. Obviously, that's not the case, but he says, I have the gout, and he's laid up. And so whenever it was politically advantageous, the gout would flare up for Hancock. Mm-hmm. And that was the case here. He wanted to be president of the convention, but doesn't attend. He stays home in Boston, where the convention is meeting. And so the lieutenant governor presides over as deputy president of the convention. And for 3 weeks, they debate it. And at the end of 3 weeks, everyone realizes if a vote is taken, the Constitution will be defeated. And so the Federalists, as great politicians as they are all over the country, they come up with a scheme. They come up with 9 recommendatory amendments. They will ratify unconditionally, but they will recommend that the Massachusetts senators and the Massachusetts representatives in the first Congress will be instructed to propose amendments to the Constitution under Article 5 of the Constitution. And so they proposed this method of ratification to President Hancock, who's laid up. They don't like him. They hate him. They're in a different political party. And they approach him and they say, John, you know we don't like you, but what we'll do is we want you to present these amendments as yours. There's 9 amendments. And if you do, we'll support you in the spring election for governor. We won't have an alternative candidate. And also, we'll support you as Vice President of the United States. And you know, John, if Virginia doesn't ratify, George Washington will not be eligible to be president. What do you think, John?
My gosh, it's horse trading.
Yes. The next day, Hancock is literally carried into the convention on a litter.
Uh-huh.
And he says, do I have a plan for you? Here are these 9 recommendatory amendments that I came up with. And he puts it on the table. And other anti-federalists said, that's not your handwriting. That's the handwriting of Theophilus Parsons, a great lawyer at the time, a Federalist. And Hancock said, no, they're mine. And for whatever reason, Samuel Adams gets up and seconds that. Samuel Adams, the arch anti-federalist, who's been silent during the convention because his son, who's an adult, Samuel Adams Jr., a physician, dies. In fact, the convention takes off a day to go to the funeral. And so Samuel Adams is not able to be at his full political strength at this mm-hmm. time. He's not arguing heavily against the Constitution as he might have at another time. But he gets up, seconds Hancock's proposal, and they ratify by a slim majority of 19. That changes everything. The 6 out of the next 7 states that ratify use that process of recommendatory amendments. Without that process, I don't think there's any doubt the Constitution would not have been adopted in the fashion that we know.
It's so important, John. So what everyone was concerned about is that if someone ratifies, if a state ratifies, but ratifies conditionally, you know, only if you do this or such, then how do you even figure out whether there's enough votes to ratify? I mean, unless you have 9 unconditional ratifications, you haven't satisfied Article 7 of the proposed Constitution, arguably. So what they wanted, nice, clean ratifications, yes. and they had to have these recommendations in order to get them through. Technically, they're unconditional ratifications.
Not technically. In reality, they are.
Okay, they are, but here's all the stuff we really want you guys to get down and work on when the new government is set up. And that's enough to satisfy at least enough of the anti-federalists to get a slim majority.
Absolutely.
There's compromise again.
Cecilia Kenyon, who's a great historian, she wrote an article in the 1950s called The Anti-Federalists, Men of Little Faith. She couldn't have been more wrong. These were anti-federalists opposing the Constitution, and they went out on faith to accept their political opponents' promise that they would discuss these amendments. And many of them turned on this when the Congress came about, and they opposed any amendments. In fact, in the Massachusetts first federal elections, they labeled those folks who wanted amendments as amendment mongers or amendmentites that have to be opposed, do not elect them to the Congress. And so the anti-federalists were in fact men who went out with tremendous faith that their political opponents would agree with them. Now, I should say that one of the things you said, I don't necessarily agree with. Everybody agrees with you, except for me, maybe.
Perfectly all right. But very few people agree with me sometimes, it seems.
Okay.
All right.
But when you say you had to comply with the 7th article of the Constitution, they felt that way, too, but it wasn't necessary. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. In New York, the convention is considering to ratify for 2 years. And if things don't happen the right way, that is, if there's not a second general convention to consider amendments, then that ratification would lapse. Now, that's a proposal that's put forth. And Hamilton, in the convention, writes a letter to Madison, who's in Congress in New York City. The convention of New York is meeting in Poughkeepsie, 90 miles away. And Hamilton says, is this a viable method of ratifying? And Madison writes back and says, no, it's not. Now, my argument would be, who appointed James Madison to be the police of ratification?
Well, if anyone should be in charge of ratification, it seems to me that James Madison's as good a candidate as any other, but I get John's point. Thanks very much to John Kaminsky for talking to us about ratification today, and sorry to you that we have to cut him off now, but we're just about out of time here. But don't worry, next week, come on back and we'll finish our discussion and you'll hear all about the various votes in the various states and how dramatic it got at the very end. And I'll give you a heads up here, Virginia, as almost always is the case, was right on the front of that particular issue. Let me see, our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. My name is Stuart Harrison. Before I go, let me remind you, we're all over the internet. Just Google your weekly constitutional, and you can listen to any of our over 100 podcasts. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.